Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this lecture by Mr. Justice Sharp. My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Socio-Legal Studies here and a fellow of this college. So it's a pleasure to welcome you to this lecture sponsored by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society and Wolfson College. It's a part of a series of lectures and workshops we have on courts and social policy, on constitutions, the science of constitutions, as we like to call it, and civil litigation, civil procedure, another area of interest. So you've probably been to our foundation events before. If you're interested in following them further, please go to our website, fljs.org, where you'll see our program for the future. But this evening, we're starting off a workshop with the lecture by Justice Sharp, the workshop being the same title as the lecture, How Judges Decide. One of the oldest questions, I suppose, that's been asked and argued about since time began. So let me introduce our speaker tonight. Robert Sharp holds degrees from Toronto University. He did his doctorate here in Oxford, more years ago than he likes to remember. Then he was called to the bar in Ontario and practiced civil litigation for some years. He then saw the light and joined the Toronto Law Faculty, where he soon rose to high levels and became dean of the faculty there for some years. Then, interestingly, he moved to the Ontario Court of Justice before finally, where he is now, being moved on to the Court of Appeal. Robert is a regular visitor to Oxford and has been coming to the Oxford Law Faculty as a visiting professor for some years and brings with him a lot of expertise and experience to share with colleagues and students. You may wonder how he managed it, but Robert has a long list of books, and I'm only going to mention a few of them. So the first book, which I remember, was his doctorate thesis, was a very original and timely book on habeas corpus. That was followed by a biography of a former Canadian Chief Justice, Brian Dixon. Then Robert turned his attention to the Canadian Charter of Rights, on which he has written. I think his main scholarly interest at the moment, apart from How Judges Decide, is a series of case studies of Canadian legal history. So you get a good sense of not only a very distinguished judge, but also someone who's managed very much to straddle the lines between academic world, scholarly writing, and the judicial process. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Robert Sharp.
Thank you very much for that introduction. As Professor Galligan has explained, the question, how judges decide, is a very old question. I've been a judge, as he's told you, for over 20 years, and I will confess to you right at the start that I do not find it an easy question to answer. What I will try to do is explain some of the problems that we have. I'll start by focusing on the problem of legal uncertainty, especially in what lawyers call hard cases, that is, cases where the law does not point to a clear answer. Hard cases arise in private law adjudication, but of course they also arise increasingly and more prominently in human rights cases. I will ask, why is it that the law is uncertain? And I will suggest that an element of uncertainty is inevitable and inherent in the idea of law itself. I will then turn to the question of where legal uncertainty leaves the judge who must decide a hard case. And finally, I will turn to some of the constraints that the law imposes on the judge charged with responsibility of deciding a hard case. I will leave it to you whether those constraints are convincing or sufficient. Now, the very idea of law suggests the need for clear rules capable of producing just and predictable results to govern society and social relations. Yet one of the greatest judges of the 20th century, Benjamin Cardozo, wrote, "I was much troubled in spirit in my first years on the bench to find how trackless was the ocean on which I had embarked. I sought for certainty. I was oppressed and disheartened when I found that the quest for it was futile." The ideal system, said Cardozo, would be a code at once so flexible and so minute as to supply in advance for every conceivable situation the just and fitting rule. But that level of legal perfection, Cardozo realized, and I think all judges realized, is simply unattainable. The judge is often confronted with deciding cases for which the law seems to provide no clear answer. A different but related problem arises where the law does provide a clear answer, but the result appears to the judge to be unjust. The twin phenomena of legal uncertainty and laws that sometimes produce unjust results arise from what I believe to be an essential element, essential characteristic of law itself. Laws must be framed in terms of norms or standards that have general application. As far long ago, someone as ancient as Aristotle observed, all law is universal. Generality gives the law its objective, rational, and systemic quality. It is what distinguishes the law on the one hand from judicial decisions in specific cases on the other. So laws set standards, but they do not decide specific cases. To decide whether or how the law applies to a particular case requires exercising judgment. Someone must decide what the facts are, identify the relevant legal norm or standard, and then determine whether and to what extent the legal norm or standard governs. That is the role of the judge, to interpret the standard and to decide whether or not it applies to the particular facts of the case. And the need for judicial fact-finding and judicial interpretation injects a significant element of uncertainty into the law. Aristotle also recognized that although universality is an identifying feature of the law, it can also be a source of injustice. The law, he wrote, takes account of the majority of cases, though not unaware that in this way errors are made. Despite the errors, he continued, the law is nonetheless right, because the error lies not in the law nor in the legislator, but in the nature of the case, for the raw material of human behavior is essentially of this kind. In this passage, Aristotle identified a central dilemma in achieving justice under law. Universality of application is a necessary attribute of law and ensures that most cases will be justly decided. But because of the variability of the raw material of human behavior, the universal legal norm will not yield just results in all cases. Needless to say, judges have a strong inclination to decide cases justly. And one of the central conundrums of judging is knowing when best to accept a result that seems unjust in order to uphold the integrity of the universal standard, and when the standard leaves sufficient room for the judge to avoid the apparent injustice. Law is also uncertain because its application is contextual. As a judge, I do not see the law as an abstraction, but rather as a tool that I work with to decide disputes in a practical way that achieves social peace and justice and harmony in the real world. The proper interpretation and application of legal rules depends upon the context. To take a familiar example, the precise meaning of the law's promise of equality changes as social conditions and attitudes evolve. Same-sex relationships, not long ago criminalized, now enjoy legal protection. How did this happen? Equality has long been a cornerstone of the rule of law, but its meaning takes on changing hue as social attitudes and practices evolve. But if the answer to the question, what does the law say about this, is always, that depends on the context, is the law rendered unstable and uncertain? And is there too much that is left subject to the perceptions, beliefs, biases, and prejudices of the judge deciding the case? The narrow legalistic version of formalism that prevailed well into the 20th century and that to some extent survives to this day, resists the idea that the meaning of law is shaped by context. Legal formalism conceives the law to be an objective, internally coherent body of rules and principles that can be objectively derived from the text of statutes and precedents and applied deductively to decide disputes without reference to the social or political context. While I accept that legal reasoning has a formal structure to which judges must adhere, my experience of deciding and hearing and deciding cases tells me that the law does not operate in a vacuum and that rigid adherence to the narrow legalistic formalist model misses, or even worse, conceals things that are very real and present in my work as a judge. The legal disputes I decide, as I've suggested, arise from the realities of daily life and from a wide range of changing social and political contexts. the legal doctrines that I am sworn to apply, be they common law or statutory in origin, are imbued with moral, philosophical, and social values. To pretend that the law can be mechanically applied in a purely objective, morally neutral manner would be to ignore the important questions of what values actually drives and determines decisions. Judges do not decide cases entirely based on neutral, objective principles, and to pretend that they do so conceals a significant component of judicial reasoning and discourages judges from reflecting upon and questioning the values that they do apply. Now, the narrow legalistic version of formalism that I've described has been under attack in the common law world for the past 100 years. Legal realists, followed by critical legal studies and other schools of thought, Art claimed that conventional legal reasoning is incoherent and indeterminate and based upon nothing but raw political choice. We also have, from the other end of the political spectrum, the law and economics movement that shares that perception of law as lacking coherence and credibility and seeks to replace it with the idea of utility and economic efficiency. Now, these schools of thought, I think, have achieved less traction in Canada and the United Kingdom than they have in the United States. But I suggest it would be a serious error to discount their influence. I think that many aspects of the once radical realist attack have more or less been absorbed into conventional legal thinking. Most lawyers and judges now accept the notion that the law is imbued with moral, political, and social values. We accept as well that the law and legal rules should be viewed and shaped in the terms of the broader social, political, and economic context in which they operate. We no longer see law as a self-contained end in itself, but rather as a tool that can be used to achieve social harmony, peace, and justice. We recognize that this renders the law less certain, and that there are hard cases in which the legal outcome is difficult to predict. But if the law is uncertain and dependent upon the context, where does that leave the judge? Does it mean that unless I retreat to narrow legalism, the theory I reject, I have to go about my work on the basis of that law is inherently indeterminate and I can do as I please? H.L.A. Hart, the English legal philosopher, aptly described these two extremes as, on the one hand, the realist nightmare that judges never decide according to the law, and on the other hand, the idealist noble dreamers who claim that judges always decide according to the letter of the law. Now, some judges, I think, embrace as liberating the idea that the law is indeterminate. But others find that notion unsettling and threatening, and probably most judges, including me, fit somewhere in between the two extremes. They reject the unthinking, narrow, rigid formalism that prevailed during the early years of the 20th century, but at the same time, they recognize that the abandonment of legal formalism leaves them and the law they administer exposed and in a constant search for an anchor to legitimate their task. As Michael Kirby, a former member of the High Court of Australia, put it, we search for a point somewhere between the spectacle of the judge pursuing political ideas of his or her own, irrespective of the letter of the law, and the unrealistic mechanic deified by the strict formalists. Now let me pause here to put the question of judicial decision-making and legal uncertainty into proper perspective. We should not exaggerate the significance of legal uncertainty by focusing exclusively on the most difficult and contentious cases that come before some apex courts. As a practical matter, for most disputes, the law does provide a discernible rule by which the parties can govern their affairs. Virtually all social and economic interactions and transactions proceed without litigation on the basis of legal rules that the parties can identify, accept, and follow. When disputes do arise, most settle before legal proceedings are initiated, and even when the parties find themselves in litigation, most cases settle before trial. Of the cases that go to trial, most involve questions of issues of fact and not law. Few trial decisions are appealed. So by focusing on the most difficult appellate decisions, we are looking at the very tip of the pyramid of disputes and ignoring the vast bulk of readily resolved disputes that lie at the base. For example, I sit on an intermediate appellate court, and a very large percentage of the cases we hear, I would say 80 to 85%, fall into what I would describe as error correction. That is, cases where the issue is whether or not the trial judge erred in the application of a settled legal principle. In these cases, the law, combined with the trial judge's findings of fact and credibility, channel the debate, and our decisions have little or no jurisprudential significance. So we should not become too obsessed with hard cases, the difficult cutting-edge cases Where Uncertainty Reigns, those are the cases that catch the headlines. Our encounter with those trees, what I call the trees, the tough cases, may cause us to lose sight of the forest, that is, the law. But we have to admit that there are cases where the correct result is anything but clear. These are the cases that perplex legal theorists in search of a sound and coherent explanation for judicial decision-making. The prime example is decisions on fundamental rights and freedoms. What do we mean by equality, liberty, freedom of expression? The precise meaning of these rights and freedoms has been a matter of debate among politicians, lawyers, and moral philosophers for centuries, and it is doubtful that we will ever arrive at a complete or settled meaning. We realize that the direction the law takes in such cases is contingent on many factors, including when the case comes before the court, who argues it, who decides it, and the political climate of the day. It is here that the once radical but now accepted critique of the formalist model comes to the fore. And I think it is difficult for judges to confront this issue rather than hide behind the myth of strict legalism. The role of the judge, especially a Supreme Court judge, is not, as Chief Justice John Roberts infamously claimed at his confirmation hearing, nothing more than that of a baseball umpire who simply calls balls and strikes. Myths and fictions of that kind are dangerous, not only because they are wrong, but because they discourage judges from being honest and reflective about the values they bring to judging. The English legal philosopher H.L.A. Hart argued that in these hard cases, when the law does not dictate an answer, the judge has the discretion to decide the case according to his own beliefs or values, and to follow standards or reasons for decision which are not dictated by law. Now, I have to say that Hart's answer does not accord with how I conceive my role when I'm confronted with such a case. I accept that the law does not dictate a clear answer and that I do have a choice, but I am unable to infer from that that my decision-making responsibility can accurately be described as choosing from a range of equally acceptable results on the basis of my own personal views and values. I accept that any claim that we can confidently predict or know the right answer to every case that comes before the court is doomed to fail. Different judges will see different issues in different ways, and different judges acting in perfectly good faith and sharing an eager desire to do justice will disagree. But when I sit down to write my reasons, I find it difficult to describe my approach as being other than to do my best to come to the legally correct solution. It seems to me that correct results are what the legalist system aspires to achieve, and that my working hypothesis has to be that I am in pursuit of the right answer, even though I know that I might not be able to claim with any confidence that I've found it. Now, many people, including perhaps many of you in this room here tonight, find this answer unsatisfactory. Even Ronald Dworkin, who argued that there were right answers, was driven to rely on the Hercules construct, a lawyer, as he described, a lawyer of superhuman skill, learning, patience, and acumen to decide the hard cases. I am no Hercules, and my skill, learning, patience, and acumen are far from superhuman, and yet I still have to decide those hard cases. I think, though, that it is important for judges to focus on the ideals or the aspirations of our law and not upon our own shortcomings and human failings. That I am no Hercules does not relieve me from thoroughly performing my Herculean task. In hard cases, my decision will make new law. That is an awesome responsibility. To carry it out in a manner acceptable in a democratic society, I must strive to identify and remain faithful to a vision of law as a coherent set of norms and standards. As a judge, I work within an institutional framework and a process that aims to achieve that aspiration, a framework that guides and disciplines the process of judicial decision making. So let me now come to some of the constraints that guide me when I try to decide one of these hard cases. Legal reasoning has much in common with forms of argument used outside the law. Lawyers and judges use the method of philosophy, reasoning by analogy, and logical progression from moral and ethical principles. Lawyers also use the method of history, considering the way legal doctrines have evolved. And finally, lawyers and judges use the method of social science, examining social values, morals, and welfare. But while lawyers and judges rely on other disciplines to do their work, legal reasoning does have some distinctive features. The first, and perhaps most significant, is that legal reasoning operates within a defined framework that requires arguments to have a pedigree that qualifies them as legitimate. This limits the bite of arguments that lack that pedigree or are based on factors external to it. Fundamental to the very idea of law and the nature of legal argument is that a judge's choice when deciding a case is constrained. Simply put, a judge is not free to decide cases on the basis of what seems to the judge, all things considered, to be the best possible outcome. The judge is not allowed to consider all things. The judge is charged with finding the result that best fits with the relevant legal principles and rules, not the result that comports with the judge's personal view of right and wrong. Scientists, philosophers, and social scientists are engaged in a search for the truth, and they're unconstrained by authority. Legal reasoning is different. Sir Edward Coke, the great legal scholar and judge who fought to establish the common law constitution and the independence of the judiciary in the early 17th century, spoke of the artificial reason of the law, which he distinguished from natural reason. Refuting James I's claim to be the font of all justice, Coke argued that even if the king was endowed with what he called excellent science, the rights of the king's subjects had to be decided not by the king using natural reason, but by the judges using, in Coke's words, the artificial reason and judgment of the law. Now, as I've said, the artificial reason of the law does not put judges and lawyers in an impossible legal straitjacket. As I've suggested, legal standards are by nature general and open-ended. They do afford judges considerable latitude to reach just results in individual cases, and there is certainly scope for judges to develop the law to make it more just. The wise judge will take into account the moral, historical, and philosophical roots of the legal standards he is interpreting and applying, but the wise judge will also probe and prod to see if there are not holes to be poked in a formal legal argument that leads to an unjust result. But wise judges must also recognize that the artificial reason of the law imposes limits on their capacity to make the world a better place. What one author has called the pervasive formality of law and the tendency to take its rules and their words seriously, even though in some cases they might work an injustice, is what distinguishes the law from other decision-making contexts. So legal doctrine does matter, and the law does limit my choices, even when I'm trying to achieve justice in the individual case. I have to apply constitutionally valid statutes as they are written. To take a familiar example, I may not like a statutory minimum sentence that requires me to impose a sentence that I consider to be unduly harsh. But if the statute passes constitutional muster, I have no choice. The doctrine of precedent or stare decisis requires me to follow binding decisions even if I do not like the result they reach. And even when deciding a hard case for which the precedents provide no clear answer, the doctrine of precedent, in my view, constrains me. If I make a decision in a hard case, my decision stands as a precedent that I and all other judges at my level or below in the judicial hierarchy must follow in the future. The fact that my pronouncement will bind me, my colleagues, and the lower courts makes me cautious. It significantly constrains my power to decide the case on the basis of my personal views, and it reinforces my obligation to decide cases in a principled legal fashion, one that best fits with the established law and the prevailing norms or standards of our legal system. Another constraint is that as a judge of an appellate court, virtually every decision I make is reached through a collegial process. The process of collegial decision making is a strong counterweight to any tendency to be influenced by values extraneous to the law. It requires me to engage not only with the arguments presented by the litigants and the lawyers, but also with any opposing views from my colleagues when we debate the case in the conference room and as we prepare our reasons for judgment. The collegial process ensures that the extraneous personal views of each judge are diluted in my court by two, sometimes four other judges, and at the Supreme Court by eight others. Another important constraint on judicial authority is imposed by the allocation of decision-making authority to other decision-makers. Judges operate within a legal and constitutional order that defines the decision-making powers of various actors. Judges are required, as I've suggested, to respect the authority of our democratically elected parliament, provincial legislatures, and municipalities to pass laws. Provided those institutions act within the limits imposed by the Constitution, judges must accept the decisions, accept the laws they enact, even when they do not like or agree with the laws. Judges must also respect the decision-making authority conferred on other adjudicators. Administrative agencies and tribunals are empowered to decide myriad issues and disputes. Provided those agencies and tribunals are acting reasonably and within the limits of the power they enjoy, judges must accept their decisions, even in cases where they would have decided otherwise. Trial judges have primary responsibility to find the facts, and appellate judges must respect that authority, unless the finding was unreasonable, even when the appellate judge thinks the trial judge probably got it wrong. Many decisions by first instance decision makers are discretionary. A judge who sits higher in the judicial hierarchy may disagree with the first instance decision maker's exercise of discretion, but if it falls within the margin of appreciation allowed by the law, the appellate judge must swallow his personal misgivings and uphold the decision. The obligation imposed on appellate courts to defer to the factual findings and discretionary decisions of trial judges represents a very significant discipline on appellate decision making. Judges are also constrained by the way the parties have defined the dispute and by the evidence the parties lead. Party definition of issues and presentation of the facts are fundamental features of our adversarial system. Judges do not get to define or shape the scope of the dispute they are asked to decide. If a litigant decides not to advance an issue or an argument, judges almost always respect the litigant's choice, even if the judge would have presented the case differently. On appeal, the trial record is all important, and it significantly constrains the appellate court. Appeal judges are reluctant to consider arguments or facts not introduced before the trial court. Allowing a losing litigant to shift ground and advance a new argument on appeal would be unfair to the opposing party, and it would also undermine the integrity of the trial process. Now, there are certainly legal scholars and many lawyers and judges who doubt the efficacy of some of these constraints. And many of you may share those doubts. Critics acknowledge that the form of legal argument and judicial reasoning reflects these constraints, but argue that the form is little more than a convenient mask for what really drives judicial decision-making, namely the judge's personal views. That brings me to what I will describe as the discipline of reasons. The obligation to give reasons is more than a legal formality. Popular opinion is increasingly skeptical of those who have and exercise authority. The culture of transparency demands justification from all those who wield power in modern democratic societies. The judiciary cannot escape the kind of scrutiny to which other public officials exercising power are exposed. The public want to know what values, opinions, and attitudes the judges bring to bear on the task of deciding cases. This, I think, is closely related to the erosion of confidence in the legalistic ideal of the objectivity of the law. As I've suggested, one does not have to be a legal realist or an adherent of the critical legal studies movement to be skeptical of Chief Justice Roberts' claim that as a judge, he simply calls balls and strikes. Because of that skepticism, we do not allow Chief Justice Roberts just to say strike. We require him to provide a reasoned opinion based upon recognized and accepted legal sources to explain why it's a strike. When the judge gives reasons, the first and for most judges, perhaps probably the most important audience, is the parties to the case, and in particular, the losing party. The parties have a right to reasons, and the judge is speaking directly to them, demonstrating as best she can that she has heard and understood the evidence, the arguments, and the relevant law, and that she has explained why one party has lost and why the other party has won. Litigants are entitled, as a simple matter of justice and fairness, to reasons. The right to a reasoned decision may be seen as an aspect of the right to be heard. As a reputed English judge observed in this regard, the most important person in the courtroom is the litigant who's going to lose. Without a reasoned decision to explain why the litigant lost the case, the litigant can have no confidence that the judge actually understood and grappled with the issues. As the English Court of Appeal has stated, Justice will not be done if it is not apparent to the parties why one has won and the other has lost. Lord Denning, a very famous judge, explained that reasons give proof that the judge has heard and considered the evidence and arguments, and that she has not taken extraneous considerations into account. Our Supreme Court of Canada has located the right to reasons in the dignity interest, an interest, the court says, that lies at the heart of post-World War II jurisprudence. An academic commentator put it this way: reasons may be regarded as an integral part of treating the disappointed litigant with the respect with which his dignity as a citizen demands. In a like vein, another author states that reasons have a humanizing effect, demonstrating on the part of the judge towards the losing party. As Sir Robert McGarry put it years earlier, to be condemned without being understood is as bad as to be condemned unheard. We will never make the losing party happy, but a reasoned decision will be more acceptable because it demonstrates to the losing party that he was heard and that his arguments were understood and grappled with. Now, the second audience, and this applies to all but judges of apex courts, the second audience when writing one's reasons for judgment is the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court. And this is an important constraint that operates on judges, because the judge knows that his reasons are subject to scrutiny by a higher court and that the decision may be reversed if it reveals legal error. The judge must do his best to explain the decision in a way that shows the higher court precisely why he decided as he did, so that the higher court can exercise its oversight role and ensure that the decision comports with the law. The third audience, especially important for apex courts, is the public, not just the wider legal community, but also the public at large. The judge has to realize, as I've suggested, that her decision-making authority is an exercise of public power, and that the integrity and authority of the court on which she sits will suffer if her decisions are not based on accepted legal standards. Reasons make judges publicly accountable for their decisions. The public, as well as the litigants, is entitled to an explanation. As a Canadian scholar has observed, reasons provide a basis for public and political debate about the justice of the particular decision and of the underlying law that authorized it. Reasons, therefore, foster public confidence in the judicial process. The obligation to provide reasoned decisions forces judges to be transparent. The legal culture of justification comports with this more general culture of justification that pervades modern democratic life. Reasons open the window to why a decision was made and, in turn, assures the public that the decision was not arbitrary. The Supreme Court of Canada sees the need to provide reasoned judgments as being central to the legitimacy of judicial institutions in the eyes of the public. Reasons for judicial decisions are necessary to bridge the gap between judicial power and democratic legitimacy. Reasons allow unelected judges to demonstrate to the public that the judicial process is legitimate and based upon sound principle and rationality. By providing reasons and exposing to public view the basis for judicial decisions, judges provide the means for public scrutiny, accountability, and, most importantly, where appropriate, criticism. I believe that the obligation to expose one's reasons for decision to the legal community and the public at large represents a significant constraint upon the exercise of judicial power. Judges are members of the legal community and the legal culture that proudly and publicly proclaims its sense of integrity, propriety, and commitment to the rule of law. Reasons cement the judge's adherence to those values and his or her obligation to abide by the limits they impose. By providing reasoned decisions, judges demonstrate that they are not, as the realists and the judicial cynics claim, simply deciding on the basis of their own personal views, but rather that they are operating within the limits imposed by the legal regime and the judicial function. As a New Zealand judge has put it, judges are constrained by their adherence to the rule of law, and they will consciously strive to reach a decision which is acceptable within the bounds of that concept rather than self-indulgently impose their own will or ideal. Reasons demonstrate that the decision was not arbitrary or based on personal whim. Reasons reflect our obligation to expose our thinking to the parties, the appeal process, the academics, the media, the public, and the politicians. If reasons are not based on sources and arguments accepted by the legal community, or fail to abide by relevant and accepted legal norms, they will not withstand scrutiny, whether in the legal court of appeal or in the court of public opinion. Reasons, I say, therefore, constrain judicial power and both limit and legitimate judicial creativity by demonstrating that judges are not simply deciding the case on the basis of their own personal views or predilections, but rather that they are operating within the circumscribed boundaries implicit in the judicial function and imposed by law. Ronald Dworkin links the obligation to provide reasons with the virtue of integrity that requires all who exercise power to act in a principled and coherent manner towards all citizens. He argues, and I agree with this argument, that reasons encourage judges to conceive of the body of the law they administer as a whole, rather than as a set of discrete decisions that they are free to make or amend one by one, thereby avoiding arbitrary distinctions between similar cases and basing decisions upon a principle that forms a single coherent scheme of justice and fairness. Retired South African Constitutional Court Judge Albie Sachs, by no means an unduly formalistic judge, provides what I think is a compelling explanation of the discipline of reasons. Sachs once stated, "Every judgment I write is a lie." Why a lie? Because according to Sachs, contrary to their appearance, legal judgments do not emerge from the dispassionate placing of logical propositions in a rationally ordained sequence, and these are his words, but rather from an inchoate, even chaotic mental firmament, with an enormous amount of random intuitive searching and surging element of unruly, free-flowing sensibility. Sounds pretty scary. The final form of the judgment, said Sachs, fails to reveal the complex mental process that the judge follows to come to his or her decision. Now, if Sachs stopped there, and the judicial decision-making would be reduced to nothing more than a shallow charade and subterfuge for judges to decide cases on the basis of their own personal and private views. But Sachs goes on to provide a valuable insight that significantly qualifies his claim that every judgment is a lie. He identifies two phases of the decision-making process. The first phase, the one that corresponds with intuition or sometimes called the judicial hunch account of judicial decision-making, he describes as the logic of discovery. The logic of discovery describes how a judge starts the mental process of sifting through the evidence and the legal arguments to come to an initial or tentative conclusion. The second phase he describes as the logic of justification. And what that reveals is that the initial journey of discovery will not suffice. In Sachs' words, a discovery that cannot be justified simply cannot stand. So the sound and conscientious judge will not decide a case solely on the basis of her initial hunch or initial discovery of what seems to be the right result. The sound and conscientious judge must justify the result on the basis of what Sachs describes as accepted principles, rules, and standards to arrive at a conclusion that is consistent with those rules, principles, and standards. Every judge has what we call it just won't right moment. The judge feels pulled to decide the case in one way, but when she sits at her desk to prepare her reasons, she finds they just won't write. A discovery that won't write cannot survive as a judgment. The judicial reasoning process that starts with an intuition and flashes of inspiration must end with a reasoned judgment capable of justifying the result, even if that means, in Sachs' words, causing the judge to abandon even the strongest initial intuition. United States Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg makes a similar observation. She says, a court charged with defining the law may not rely on unarticulated intuition. The court is obliged conscientiously to reason why. So I see my task as being, when I'm deciding a hard case, as being constrained by the need to fit a result, to find a result that best comports with the fabric and texture of the legal rules and principles pertinent to the dispute. I have to accept that often there are many gaps and holes in the fabric, and that the fabric does not provide me with a ready answer. So what I must do is simply do my best to complete the weave in a proper and coherent manner. I can make no philosophical claim that I have found the truth, but I argue that the integrity of the legal process compels me to define my responsibility in terms of providing a reasoned justification for my decision that aims to persuade the litigants, the legal community, and the public that I did my best to reach the right result. So, in conclusion, at the end of the day, after I've rendered my judgment in a hard case, and I ask myself, did I reach the right answer? I'm actually never quite sure. But I do want to be absolutely certain of a number of things. That my reasons demonstrate to the litigants that they were fairly heard, that I grappled with the arguments that they made, that I assess those arguments and analyze them in a manner that respects the need for legal coherence and integrity, and in a manner which comports with accepted principles and legal norms of our culture. Thank you.